Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Lori McGee, and it is my privilege to serve as worship leader for today's service. I'm joined today by Worship Associate Bonnie Harper, Director of Religious Education Karen Lapidus, and Music Director Hal Walker with special guest Margot Milsetich. We are delighted to welcome you to this religious community. We light our chalice this morning in solidarity with oppressed peoples in this nation and across the globe.
Prayer, prayer for the morning after Ferguson by Audette Fulbright, and she wrote it November 25th, 2014. Did you rise this morning, broken and hungover with weariness and pain, and rage tattered from waving too long in a brutal wind? Get up, child. Pull your bones upright. Gather your skin and muscle into a patch of sun. Draw breath deep into your lungs. You will need it, for another day calls to you. I know you ache. I know you wish the work were done, and you, with everyone you ever loved, were on a distant shore, safe and unafraid. But remember this, tired as you are not alone. Here, and here also, there are others weeping and rising and gathering their courage. You belong to them, and they to you, and together we will break through and bend the arc of justice all the way down into our lives. Please come, let us worship together.
The time for all ages this morning was difficult for me to write. It's not a funny story, nor is it a wisdom tale that teaches a life lesson or a short skit that illustrates a principle or a value. It's about something difficult. But churches are places where we mark the most meaningful aspects of our lives and we bring our most meaningful concerns. So here we go. I'm going to talk a bit about girls. Not the girls that are most likely in your lives, the girls who attend school and the girls who are encouraged to follow their dreams and the girls whose parents hope that when they grow up, they'll fall in love and partner with the person of their choice. But I'm going to talk a bit about the girls in other countries around the world whose lives are very different because they do not enjoy the civil rights that most middle-class American girls do. So here are just a few disturbing facts that I've learned recently about the human rights of girls worldwide. I learned that 1 out of 7 girls in the world gets married before they are 18 years old, often not knowing the man until the moment they are married. And I've learned that 30% of all teenage girls in the world do not attend school, and many of those girls are married and caring for children. And I learned that in the 25 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, 71% of the water collected for all the cooking and cleaning is collected by the women and the girls. And most of this water is carried on their heads and transported great distances every day. This daunting task keeps girls from attending school. And I could share even more facts with you, but some things that I learned about the lives of girls worldwide are difficult to say out loud. So now that we know, what can we do? Thankfully, there are many service organizations who are paying attention to these violations of human rights and whose work helps lift up the lives of girls around the world. And thankfully, there are organizations that we can support with our donations that are working to educate people about the health risks to girls who marry and have babies while they themselves are still children. And thankfully, there are organizations that we can support who are building schools for girls. You may recall that not long ago, I shared with you how the First Unitarian Church of Pittsburgh is supporting the Unitarian Church in the Khasi Hills of India to build and support a school there. One of these helping organizations is our own Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, or the UUSC. Their mode of delivering service is to partner with the groups of people that they seek to help. The UUSC is working with countries in Africa to give all people access to available clean water, thus working to eliminate the need for women and girls to carry water such far distances. And so I encourage you to remember these facts that I've shared with you and to look into other ways so that many of the girls in the world that are living hard begin to live fulfilled lives and remember that we can help. Now we'll sing our children and their teachers to their classrooms. The words are in your order of service. We'll sing twice, move the second time through.
I share with you these words from the Dhammapada, an Indian sacred text. Never does hatred cease by hating in return. Only through love can hatred come to an end. Victory breeds hatred. The conquered dwell in sorrow and resentment. Those who give up all thought of victory or defeat may be calm and live happily at peace. Let us overcome violence by gentleness. Let us overcome evil by good. Let us overcome the miserly by liberality. Let us overcome the liar by truth. Each week when we gather for worship, we set aside time to widen the caring ministry of this congregation. We take time to memorialize those who have died, to celebrate with those who are joyous, and to call into this community of care all who need our love and support. This morning, we are mindful and remember all of the people across this nation who are oppressed, especially those in Ferguson and Cleveland, and all over the country where violence takes lives. Please join me now in the spirit of prayer or meditation, as is your practice. My eyes feel the deep peace of this sky, and there stirs through me what a tree feels when it holds out its leaves like cups to be filled with sunshine. A thought rises in my mind, like the warm breath from grass in the sun. It mingles with the gurgling of lapping water and the sigh of weary wind in the village lanes. The thought that I have lived along with the whole life of this world and have given to it my own love and sorrows. Amen, and blessed be.
Prerequisite for living. This much we must demand: a horizon west of any place we are, our scope of splendor any time to see, all ours. And if we stretch a hand, chance that a door will open out the way we want to go. And when we turn, uncalled for, unpremeditated, from the desk ahead, from these papers towering on either hand, to peer in light for wonder, chance that the one response we lack will blossom our surprise. This much we must demand. This much we must demand when we are laboring, lost in distant thought, sudden doves to flutter from our gloom. This much we must demand. The self's dim edge to resonate with song that strikes us, bass and treble, always a whole, and shadows to offer up in strange projections, angles of vision never dreamed in air, and the merest possibility of, after much thoughtless straining with both hands, some word, both warm and wise, for one another, some simple play to put ourselves together, some room enough to be in. This much we must demand.
The impetus for this service began several months ago during a class I took at the Stark campus of Kent State, where I work. For those who may not know, I am a Spanish professor there, and one of the perks of working at a university is being able to take classes for free. I have always been interested in world religions, so when I saw that a colleague of mine was offering a philosophy class called Comparative Religious Thought, during a time when I was available to take it, I decided to enroll. During the course, we studied the five major world religions: Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. The actual spark for this service came when our campus hosted, as part of a featured speaker series, two Indian American women who were leading a grassroots organization to help the Dalit, formerly known as Untouchables, in India. These women, Fenmoy Sundararajan and Asha Kotal, were so dynamic and moving, and the stories they shared were so unbelievably terrible that I knew I had to bring this cause to your attention. But more on all of that later. First, I think in order for us to understand the caste system of India, we really need to have some understanding of Hinduism itself. But I need to admit defeat before I even begin. Hinduism is so complex, confusing, and contradictory that we as Westerners often have a hard time wrapping our minds around its concepts and beliefs. There is no way in one sermon to cover all of the aspects of this millennia-old religion. So knowing this from the outset, I will only focus on the central concepts that are necessary to understand the religious basis for and support of the caste system. Hinduism is often cited as the world's oldest religion because it is still in practice today, much as it was several thousand years ago. The central beliefs, forms of worship, and holy rituals have changed very little over time. Hinduism can be said to be monotheistic, polytheistic, and pantheistic at one and the same time. In fact, many estimates say that there are approximately 333 million gods and goddesses in Hinduism. Ultimately, however, Hindus worship the one supreme being called Brahman, with an A, Brahman. Often called the formless form, the manifest transcendence, the unknowable known. Brahman is all things, and all things are Brahman. Despite the seeming unity of Brahman, it is also viewed as a trinity of the gods, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, the creator, preserver, and destroyer, respectively. These three gods are mostly responsible for the circle of life and death and rebirth called samsara. Samsara is most widely known to us as reincarnation, but it is more than that. Samsara takes into account our worldly actions, our karma, to determine whether our soul will continue on the journey of life or if we will achieve moksha, the final release from samsara and reconnection with Brahman. So let me put all this another way. We humans are all part of Brahman, the supreme being. Each of us has unique physical and mental manifestations on this earth, but we also have contained with us, very deep within, divinity called Atman. Our task in our many lives is to uncover our Atman through observation of Dharma, universal law. By obeying Dharma, our karma gets better and better and better, and eventually we achieve moksha, a reuniting of our individual Atman with Brahman. Moksha is a state of eternal, infinite liberation from worldly ties. So here I would like to lift up a few more points about Dharma and karma. Dharma really doesn't have a direct translation into English. Most often it is said to be a universal law, divine order, duty, or obligation. Dharma is fixed, binding, and eternal. There is no negotiation when it comes to Dharma. Each of us has our own Dharma to fulfill based on our professions and positions in life. Karma translates to deed or action. Karma is not luck or chance. It is the universal principle of cause and effect, action and reaction. Karma says that we all have free will to make our own choices and create our own destinies. the totality of our actions and their concomitant reactions in this and all of our previous lives determines how quickly or slowly we achieve moksha. It is a direct result of dharma and karma that the caste system came into existence. One cannot successfully follow dharma when one is worried about social competition and mundane tasks. The original theory of the caste system was to create social strata in which equals compete with equals. It was meant to provide a system of fairness so that people of lesser talents and abilities did not have to compete socially with others of higher talents and abilities for jobs, spouses, housing, etc. The caste system was supposed to be a good thing. However, the very second humans interact with religious concepts such as this, the flaws begin to show. Very early in Hindu history, the caste system became based on racial features. Individuals with lighter skin were thought to be purer, farther along in their karmic journey than those with darker skin. These individuals rose to the top of the caste structure to become Brahmins, with an I, Brahmin. The Brahmins are the priestly, holy caste. They are considered an incarnation of Dharma itself. They are born to serve and protect Dharma on this earth. They are responsible for studying the holy texts of Hinduism and for advising royalty on religious matters. The Brahmins are the top of the top, the holiest of the holy, the purest of the pure. The second caste is the warrior caste, called Kshatriyas. Kshatriyas are India's royal family and governmental leaders. Their dharma is to protect society, study religious texts, bestow gifts upon the Brahmins, dispense justice, and maintain social order, especially with regard to the caste system. In ancient India, one of the duties of the Kshatriyas was to make sure that people did not marry outside of their caste. In order to preserve the racial purity of each caste, marriages were rigidly controlled. Even today, marriages are often arranged by parents, with the young couple meeting only for the first time on their wedding day. Although the law doesn't officially get involved in marriage arrangements in modern India, the Indian people are so accustomed to these practices that inter-caste marriages rarely occur. The third caste is that of the merchant class, the Vaishyas. Their dharma is tending cattle, studying religious texts, lending money, cultivating the land, and being tradesmen. And finally, the fourth caste is the labor class, the Shudras, whose only duty is to serve the three upper castes in whatever way necessary. They are not allowed to study the religious texts, nor even hear the sacred chants. They are not allowed to eat in the presence of the higher castes. So if you can imagine a pyramid shape, right? The Brahmins would be at the very top. They're the smallest, narrowest group. And then under them are the Kshatriyas, who are a little bit wider, but still far up there. And then beneath that are the Vaishyas, and then under that are the Shudras. So the Shudras are responsible for holding up the other three castes, so it moves in an upward trajectory. So let's return to that idea of dharma and karma again. The three upper castes are considered to be twice born. That is, as far along in their karmic journey because they have fulfilled enough of their dharma to have earned at least two lives. The Shudras are once born, not very far in their karmic journey, but by fulfilling their dharma well enough in this life, may have a chance of becoming a higher caste in a future life. Caste in this life is fixed and hereditary. One may move horizontally through one's own caste, but not vertically through the others. Eventually, an outcast group was created so that the upper castes wouldn't have to do the jobs that they considered unclean and impure. This group is India's untouchables. This group is so reviled and so abhorred that they don't even have an official name in Hindi, the Indian language. They have the worst jobs imaginable in Indian society. They are responsible for preparing bodies for ritual burning, butchering animals, working the land, sweeping streets, and removing human waste from toilet areas. Historically, they were not allowed to enter a village in the daytime, nor walk on the same streets as other castes. They had to announce their presence upon entering a village or town so that others had a chance to remove themselves from the possibility of contamination. Today, untouchables generally live in villages separate from the rest of society. They are not allowed to draw water from the same wells that the upper castes do, and often the water sources that they do have access to are polluted and disease-ridden. The villages of untouchables rarely have running water or any sort of plumbing or waste control system. For many villages, the nearest working toilet they have access to can be several kilometers away. Because of this, there are often sections of public streets that are used for human waste. Untouchable women in these villages have the job of removing this waste on a daily basis. Many people of the upper caste view the untouchables as so impure that they don't even consider them fully human. Recently, some groups of untouchables have begun to voice their displeasure with this system. They have taken the name Dalit, which means broken people, to reclaim their humanity and to fight for their rights in society. But it is a slow and difficult road. Officially, the Indian government outlawed caste and caste discrimination in 1989, but despite this, society is holding tight to this tradition. And because of the ban on caste, the government census information no longer contains demographic information on the different castes in society, which makes it very difficult to get accurate numbers of people for the different groups. We do know that there are about 1.2 billion people in India. Several top human rights organizations estimate that there are at least 300 million Dalits in India today. That is roughly the population of the entire United States. Let that sink in for a second. 300 million oppressed people. The Dalits face insurmountable obstacles and horrific violence on a daily basis. And I just want to say for some of you, if this is difficult to hear and you need to excuse yourself, please feel free to do so. The Dalits endure segregation in housing, schools, and access to public services. They are denied access to land, forced to work in degrading conditions, and are routinely abused by the police and the upper caste members. Dalits suffer routine violations of their right to safety and security through state-sponsored or sanctioned acts of violence, including torture. Dalits suffer caste-motivated killings, rapes, and other abuses on a daily basis. Dalit women face additional discrimination and abuse, including sexual abuse by the police and upper caste men, forced prostitution, and discrimination in employment and wages. Some agencies estimate that there is a crime committed against a Dalit every 10 minutes. Although due to vast and widely underreporting of these crimes, it is probably much, much worse than that. Dalit children face continuous hurdles in education. They are made to sit in the back of classrooms and endure verbal and physical harassment from teachers and other students. The effect of such abuses is confirmed by the low literacy and high dropout rates for Dalits. I was ignorant to all of this when Thanmoy and Asha came to speak to my class last April. I had no idea these kinds of atrocities were happening on such a large scale. Thanmoy shared with us many stories and videos of violence against Dalit women, one of which I want to share with you. And this is difficult to hear. There was a young woman in one of the rural villages who was gang raped by a group of upper caste men. The men videotaped this on their phones and sent it to everyone who lived in her village so that everyone could see what happened to her. So, after a period of recovery, because she actually survived, which is rare, she decided to take this video, which had been also sent to her, to the police, because she thought, well, I have video evidence, so I have to get some kind of justice. So she took it to her local police, and the police looked at it and said, I don't really see a crime here. I'm not going to take this case. And so then the police decided not to take the case. So she went to the mayor, because the mayor is the next up in the hierarchy of political peoples who are responsible for bringing justice. And the mayor looked at it and said, no, I agree with the police. I'm not going to take this case. So she has this video. She's very frustrated. She has proof of these horrible things that are happening to her. So she goes to a judge, the local judge. And the judge looks at it, he watches the video, and says, no, I agree with the police and the mayor. I'm not going to take the case. But you should at least be proud of this. And she, being horrified, said, how would I be proud of it? And he said, well, it looks like you're enjoying it, so at least you've brought pride to your family. This is a true story of something that literally happened to this young woman. So there's nowhere that these young women can turn to for help because nobody cares. It's part of the system. It's intrinsic to what is happening in India daily. And so they just don't report it. They don't report the crimes because nobody's going to do anything about it. So my first question after hearing this horrible story was, why? Why are they doing this? What do they have to gain by committing these horrible atrocities? These people are so already so beaten down, so impoverished, so helpless. Why make it worse? The short answer was because they can. The longer answer was that the upper castes often view the raping, burning, and killing of Dalit women as a way to achieve ritual purity by ridding the world of such impure people. Or it is because someone in their family tried to achieve something better by getting a better job or trying to buy a small parcel of land. Because the upper castes benefit so much from the status quo, they will do anything to squash any kind of progress the Dalits make. By committing these heinous acts of violence against these women, the families, the women of these families, the men are taught a very serious lesson. Don't try to improve your lot in life. I personally feel very called to help these people. If you share that feeling with me, there are many organizations out there that do just that. One is Thenmoy and Asha's organization, Dalit Nation, a grassroots campaign that travels around India by bus and van, on the ground, doing the work, helping women get the justice that they so deserve. Some others are the National Campaign on Dalit Human Rights, the Center for Dalit Human Rights, and the International Commission for Dalit Rights. I have typed up the websites for these organizations for you. They are in your order of service. If you did not get one, please feel free to grab one from the table when you leave. As Karen said earlier, now that we know, what can we do? What will you do? Amen, and blessed be.
Yeah.
The Bhagavad Gita tells us the unreal never is, the real never is not. This truth indeed has been seen by those who can see the true. Go as you go, seeking the truth in your life. Amen.